You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're going to continue talking about spring insects with my author, who's here, Hugh Raffles, an author of Insectopedia. And why did you – you're not an insect scientist, are you?
I'm not a scientist at all.
No. So why is an anthropologist writing a book about insects?
Well, it's really a book about relationships between people and insects rather than just insects themselves.
And tell us about that. What interests you about this? What's your motivation here?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I actually started this, I did want to write a book about insects. Mm-hmm. But I quickly figured out that I just wasn't able to do that. Insects themselves were just too difficult to make sense of. So I looked for people who had interesting relationships with them and tried to get inside those relationships a little bit. Mm-hmm. And part of what motivated me was that, you know, as we all know, insects are everywhere. We don't understand them very well. And partly also I didn't know very much about them, and it was a way for me to find out something about them.
Yeah.
But they're also extremely important in our lives in many ways, but we both tend not to notice them, and also in general in the U.S. and in Europe have pretty negative responses to them.
Yeah, and you write about the negative and positive responses to insects and how insects have been used in the course of literature, in the course of anti-Semitism, and the course of all human interaction. Somewhere there are insects found.
It seems to be that way, or at least you could say that if you start by looking at insects, you can open up very, very large worlds, actually. The example of Jews and lice, I think, is a good example of that.
Yeah. Let's hone in on one of these then. Okay. Let's talk about a cricket fight like the one you saw in China. It's fascinating.
I mean, you know, I am an anthropologist, so I spend a fair amount of time doing field work, going to interesting places, talking to interesting people. And one of those was some time I spent in Shanghai. And in China, as I'm sure many people know, there's this longstanding I don't know what you'd call it, not more than a hobby, not different from a sport, but a you know, an activity, I suppose, something of fighting, people training and fighting crickets. And people have developed, you know, tremendous expertise over the centuries. The first manual of cricket training and fighting is 900 years old. And people still refer to that and work with that, although it's obviously been updated a lot.
And if you go to a cricket fight, what do you see at a cricket fight? Crickets tearing each other apart?
Well,
because, I mean, you go to a cockfight or chickens, you see them, you know, pecking away at each other.
Well, it's not as bloody as that. And the crickets are tiny, and they're in this little clear plastic arena, but it's very dramatic. It's very, very dramatic.
And because they're representative of something else?
No, just because they're pretty dramatic themselves.
They're very
exciting fighters, and it's very compelling. And
how do you select a good cricket to be a
well,
fighter?
You know,
I know you don't.
I don't know. I don't know how to do it, but I talked to a lot of people who did, and people have extremely elaborate and sophisticated ways of doing that.
Is that right?
Yeah, really. There's this very complicated taxonomies, very, very different from, you know, Linnaean or biological taxonomies, but people have, they start off with, I think, 72 personalities or something like that. Well, actually, they start off with a series of different colors, which even the time that I was spending looking quite closely, they were indistinguishable to me, actually.
Right, but then they could tell.
People can tell very, very, very carefully, very closely, and they look for differences in, say, the shape of the antennae, the translucence of the exoskeleton, the shape of the wings, the strength. What they're looking for are signs of the something like the fighting spirit of the cricket, what it's likely to be when it gets into an arena and starts fighting.
You know, you say about crickets being revered in China. Mm. Can you imagine an insect in this country? I mean, the kind of cultural connection that the Chinese have with the cricket. What kind of insect we might have in the West? I mean, there is no such.
I don't think there's anything like that.
Yeah, why? No. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I don't have a good answer for this. I mean, what I did find was that in other places, people have very different attitudes to insects and very different relationships with them. I suppose in China and Japan, particularly, which were the two countries in East Asia that I spent time in, there's a long history of positive representations of insects, of certain insects, in literature, in painting, in all kinds of arts, and that people and you know it continues today. So in Japan, you get all kinds of insects appear in all kinds of forms in, you know, in manga and in anime and, you know, contemporary cultural forms.
Mm-hmm. And then closer to home here in the book, you take us to New Mexico and how insects are changing as a result of climate change.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book about a sound artist called David Dunn, who lived in Santa Fe and or still lives in Santa Fe, I think. And during the period of the drought that affected the juniper pinyon pine forests in I think 2000-2001, that period, he started trying to find out what was going on with the trees, and the trees were being affected by these severe invasions of bark beetles. Because he was so attuned to sound and had done environmental sound recordings, mm-hmm. he developed a way to record the sound inside trees. And he figured out that what was happening was that the trees and the beetles were getting delinked from each other. So whereas before there had been low levels of infestations and the trees could cope with them.
Right.
Because of the drought, the trees didn't have the defenses to cope with the beetles anymore. They were weakened.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the insects' reproduction was...
It's an opportunity.
Very much, yeah. So, they speed it up in every way.
Right. Yeah. Tell us what you were looking for when you went to Niger. You went there.
Yeah, well, I went there because I knew that people had these very close relationships with grasshoppers, which were both positive and negative. There were locusts that invaded fields and caused mm-hmm. famines, and that were really, you know, a severe problem. But at the same time, people ate grasshoppers and locusts.
Good source of protein.
Very good source of protein. But they're more than a source of protein. They were also like a luxury food and sort of like a fun food that people ate. So,
like popcorn or something.
Well, they're crunchy, yes. So like popcorn.
Did they have special recipes that had a cook them and prepare them? And
yeah, people have great ways of cooking them. They fry them, they cook them with chili and salt and lime. And yeah.
Wow, we should put one of those recipes up on our website. Well,
well, I don't want to encourage you to be eating insects.
Why not? I mean, what's wrong with eating insects?
Well, you know, I'm a vegan, so.
That explains it. You're a vegan. And so did you have to force yourself? You had to sample it, right, when you went over there? You couldn't judge it without taking a bite.
You know, I sort of have a rule that when I'm in control of my diet, then I'm vegan. But when I'm somewhere that I don't like offending people with food, you know, food is very personal.
Yes. So yeah. You don't want to offend them and not eat what they're eating. If you're offered the food, you eat it.
Pretty much.
And
yeah.
So, what did it taste like?
Crunchy.
Do you hold your nose and just say, "I'm going to take a bite"? What happens?
No, you know, everybody else is very enthusiastic, so it's easy to get. You know, it's easy to be enthusiastic too.
So, how do they deal with when locusts come around? Mm. Do they, if they're eating them? You said there's like this love hate relationship. They're pests on one hand, and then are they going to gather them up and fry them later, or do they just have to try to make sure they don't eat up the crops?
No, I think when it's a really severe invasion of locusts, then there's not much that people can do. People just have to pretty much get out of there. From talking to people, it appears that mostly what happens is people abandon their fields and abandon their villages, or eventually they often have to do that. But one of the things that I found from talking to people that I was very unaware of, a lot of this came out of talking to biologists in Niger, was that while locusts are this very dramatic problem, which stimulate a lot of international response because it creates such a crisis. There's a bigger problem, insect problem, which is the sort of every day and every season just presence of grasshoppers, which are more closely coordinated with the millet crop, and they can consume maybe 20-50% of people's crops. But there isn't really much international attention on them.
There isn't?
No, very, very little. So because,
even though they're devastating?
Even though they're devastating, because they create this sort of continual attrition, which is very debilitating to people's farming, but it doesn't have the kind of drama that attracts international attention.
It's not mosquitoes and kids dying and things like that.
Exactly, and it's not, you know, there's so much drama associated with a famine and with a locust. It's very locust invasion.
Unless they're making a movie about it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then people pay attention.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's an excellent book. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with the book. It's called Insectopedia. It's alphabetically listings and interesting how people interact with insects that you might never have thought about before. Hugh Raffles is the author. Thank you for being here.
Thanks very much, Aaron.
You're welcome.